I'd like to welcome everyone back to the Duck Pond Wall, a show here on WEHC where we get to sort of pretend like we're sitting on the Duck Pond Wall and catching up with a fun old friend from Emory and Henry. I'm your host, Monica Hoyle, the alumni director here at the college, and I am so excited that our guest today is Colin Christensen. How you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on.
Colin, remind us what year you graduated from Emory and Henry.
Class of 2014.
You are involved right now in Washington, D.C., and we're going to get to that. But tell us what you did after you left Emory and Henry. You went off to Berkeley, right?
Yes, ma'am. Yeah. Right after graduation, I enrolled in a PhD program at Berkeley, and I spent the better part of the last decade there, actually. I spent 8 years at Berkeley, where I was based out of the law school, but I wrote my PhD in jurisprudence and social policy. So it was a really great experience, but it was quite the culture shock going from Southwest Virginia to Berkeley, California.
Where did you grow up, Colin? I've forgotten.
Strasburg, Virginia. So the Northern Shenandoah Valley.
Okay. All right. So you've been in a couple different kinds of places. How did you end up at Emory and Henry?
Oh, this is a fun story. So do you remember the veggie bus that the outdoor program had?
Yeah, that ran on vegetable oil.
Yeah, they drove the outdoor program in, this must have been 2008 or 2009. They drove the veggie bus to some climate rally in D.C. and they passed right through Strasburg. And I like saw this cool, you know, little short bus with outdoor program logo on it. And I think I might even chatted with them like in passing. And I just thought it was the coolest thing that they had. The outdoor kids had a bus that ran on vegetable oil. And that's how I found out about the college and then promptly came down for a visit.
That it may be the best recruiting story I've heard all day. I mean, you know, you always hope that when you have those kind of vehicles on the road that it's going to get somebody's attention, but it really worked.
Yeah, and unfortunately, I think the veggie bus quickly went out of commission right after I showed up. So I didn't really get a chance to ever drive in the veggie bus myself, but it's okay. It got me down there.
I seem to recall that all that grease kind of clogged the arteries of that bus, kind of like it does for the rest of us.
Yeah, funny how that works. Yeah.
All right, now this is where I get to be dumb and ask questions. Do you have a law degree? You don't have a law degree.
No, I don't have a traditional JD. Now, I like to joke that I spent 8 years in a 3-year program and I didn't even leave with the degree. It's a really fair question. I get this a lot because I'm technically a graduate of Berkeley Law School. The PhD program I was in is a unique interdisciplinary program at the law school, and it was really designed to try and merge the traditional doctrinal study of law with social science research methods. It was a really natural extension of my coursework at Emory and Henry, where I majored in philosophy, politics, and economics. So I did this kind of very intentional interdisciplinary undergraduate program. So it made a lot of sense to go to an interdisciplinary graduate program, right?
Yeah,
and so that's how I ended up there. And I was really interested in thinking about not just law as a system of rules, but also like what are legal institutions and how do they operate and what sort of social forces and politics govern a space that we typically think of as like separate from political pressures, right? We think of law as this kind of like mechanism. So it was the perfect place to go spend a really long time with people that were studying for a traditional law degree, right? All my friends are now attorneys. And so it was great to be kind of, I like to joke that I was like cosplaying as a law student for those years. I think it was a really special time because, you know, I got to really immerse myself alongside classmates who were studying and thinking and reading about law much differently than I was. And so I could ask them questions about, you know, what's your take on this if you were a lawyer thinking about this question versus like a social scientist thinking about those same questions. So it was a great time.
That's fascinating. And I'm intrigued by what you said, you know, that we sort of think of the law as being, and I may have misunderstood what you were saying, but almost sort of outside the realm of, like, I don't know, I'm going to say the wrong word, but like not personality, but like personal issues. Like there should be, everything is written as it should be. And we should be able to refer to these things and say, this is the law and here's how it works. But is anything really devoid of that?
No, that would be my hot take, is which I don't think is that impressive of a hot take. But yeah, that's the question that really occupies and still occupies a lot of my brain space, is thinking about this thing that we treat as this kind of like standard unit of societal measurement, if you will, right? And trying to discern and dissect the non-standard forces that are often channeled through it and that it directs. That, you know, we see that everywhere, right? We see that in, you know, we see it in courtrooms, sure, but we also see it at, you know, in a social worker's office. We see it in public schools, right? See it everywhere. And so it's a really, I think it's a fun way to think about it, but to answer your question, yeah, I think it's a very fanciful illusion that we like to buy into, that law is this thing that's somehow apart from us and isn't kind of marked with all of, you know, the same vicissitudes that we have as members of a kind of living society.
Yeah, well, it's because it would be nice if it were, you know, in some ways. I mean, I guess I can, of course, I can probably also think of a lot of examples where you want to be able to say, oh, yeah, but let's reconsider this based on what the situation is. But there is something to be said for the fact that you know, the way the law works, you know, where you use so much logic and you refer to previous cases and here was the decision and here's what they handed down and this really informs what we're going to do going forward. It feels like it ought to be outside that realm. But even a lot of the things that we refer to, my gosh, we're referring to court cases that happened 100 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is also, you know, right now that everything on the news, when every time you see a major federal court case, right, all the talking heads are really saying, okay, well, if the court rules this way, maybe this is a partisan decision, right? So like the kind of conceit is really out there in the open in a lot of these major court cases, whether it's because like we're turning back the wheels of time to, you know, turn to a 100-year-old decision to try and think about a contemporary problem.
Yeah.
Or whether, like, we're kind of being much more open and express about, like, okay, are there partisan leanings that are really animating the legal decision-making here?
Yeah. Well, you know, I always enjoy those shows that say ripped from the headlines. But this conversation is kind of ripped from the headlines this week, because it feels like I'm hearing a lot about this kind of thing on the news right now as the Supreme Court has been trying to figure out so much stuff. And you can't just parse it out as easily as you might think.
Right.
So let's talk about what you're doing now, because holy cow, I do have your resume. I'm not going to read it because it's very impressive and I will say things incorrectly. However, I do want people to know about this program here, because you're not in California anymore, are you?
No, ma'am. No, I'm in Washington, D.C. now.
You're Washington, D.C. And am I right that this Presidential Management Fellows is sort of a program? Is that right?
Yeah, it is the premier leadership development program for federal public service. So the kind of like elevator pitch on the program is it's a program that's designed for individuals with advanced degrees. So a lot of like master's degrees or PhDs, law degrees. There's actually a few MDs I've met that are PMS as well. It's for advanced degree holders. You have 3 years of eligibility after you complete your advanced degree. And it's a kind of funneling mechanism into management roles in the federal government. And so the year that I applied, I think there was over 10,000 applicants that
Whoa.
Year,
Whoa.
Which was the second most in the program's history. The program, I think, was started under President Carter. And it was called the Presidential Management Interns Program back then. They've since, you know, made it a little bit more fancy, and now we're fellows, not just interns. And in any case, and I think as of yesterday, you have, you know, if you're selected as a finalist, you have 1 year of eligibility to like actually get a job. And so I say, you know, it's a program. Yes, there's some structure to it, but essentially what you're doing is you're getting hired into a job at one of the executive agencies. And it's a 2-year program. So, I mean, you're proper, you know, you have a full salary and benefits. It's like that's your job. And at the end of the program, if you finish all of its requirements, it's a lot of training requirements, you can convert into a tenured civil service position. So it's a non-competitive hire. And so in any case, I'm a member of the class of 2023. There was 10,000 applicants to that class. And I think as of yesterday, there was only 377 appointed fellows from that candidate pool.
Wow.
So it's pretty competitive. Cool Emory and Henry fact that's really hot off the presses.
Yeah.
Yesterday, the 2024 class of finalists was announced, and Max Palmer, Emory and Henry class of 2017,
yeah.
I think 2017, he is a finalist this year.
Oh, look at that. So does he know yet what he's going to be doing?
No. So it's kind of a funny process. Right? Like you make the finalist, and it's a list that's published on OPM's website. And then essentially all the various federal agencies will like basically put together a job ad, and it reads just like a job ad, but it's reserved for people that are management fellow candidates. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so then you apply to it like a normal job ad. So like functionally the mechanics of going from being a finalist to being appointed as a fellow, it's kind of like having access to a special job board, and you're still competing against your other fellow finalists for those same jobs. So in my job, I was appointed as a fellow in the White House Office of Management and Budget. There, I serve as a program examiner in the Justice Branch. And so what's great is I oversee about $5 billion in the DOJ budget. So I have a portfolio that includes the immigration courts and the litigating components of DOJ. And it's really like a full spectrum policy job where we're doing, we're doing legislative and regulatory analyses. We're also doing a lot of budget formulation and evaluation as well. That comes with the territory of being in the Office of Management and Budget.
And you don't look one bit daunted by the fact that you're overseeing a $5 billion with a B dollar budget.
Yeah, if you think about it too hard, it gets very dizzying. What's interesting is, you know, prior to moving to D.C., I was working in state government in the state of California, and what's funny to me about the difference between state government and federal government is it's a lot like going from the retail level to the wholesale level, where the federal government's wholesale. And so, you know, we deal with lots of billions of dollars, and the budget itself is trillions of dollars, right? But because you're operating at this wholesale level, it's all like very macro level budgeting, mm-hmm. right? So if I was keeping track, you know, of like at an accounting level of $5 billion, like that might be like quite overwhelming.
Right.
But because at the White House, we're doing a more macro type of budgeting, it's a little, just slightly less daunting.
What did you do for the state of California?
I had such a fun job there. So I worked at this agency called the Judicial Council, and that's the policymaking body for the California judicial branch, so the California court system. And what's fun about the California court system is it's the largest court system in the United States. It's arguably the largest court system in, you know, a liberal democratic state, like altogether, like so arguably in the world. So it's this massive court system. And I was a supervising analyst in the Criminal Justice Services Division. And I worked on a project called Ability to Pay, where essentially I was responsible for overseeing the statewide policy implementation of this program that allowed low-income litigants to petition their local court for reductions in their legal financial obligations, which is a really fancy way of saying when you get a speeding ticket, it's really expensive. And if you're in poverty, a $300 speeding ticket is not always feasible for you to pay. It's certainly not, you know, commensurate with your income.
Right.
And so what we were doing was developing a tool that allowed users to go into this online system. It took like 3 to 5 minutes. They would enter some discrete bits of information about themselves and their financial situation. And then we would take that data and run it through like a calculator, essentially, and then provide judges with a recommendation for like, here's how much you should reduce their ticket to. And we think like this is what they're going to be able to actually afford to pay. And it was such a special job. It was my first job, like my first proper job out of grad school. So in many ways, it was like my first job ever. But it was so fun because I got to really be a social scientist. I was managing a team. And it was great because I had just a stellar team that some of them were really into the program side of the house. Some of them were really into the operations side of the house. And so I got to be a social scientist and work with data that people in academia would like kill for. But because it's like state data, right, like they can't have access to it. So I had special access to this great data that we were collecting in real time. And I felt like a really like heavy obligation to like use my like social scientific skills for good because I had access to something that I knew in academia would like really like people would really really like want it. So it was how can I use that academic skill set to work with this data to produce better results in the lives of people in California or people that are just like going through the California court system, right? And it was great. I mean it was the type of project where on a weekly basis we could measure the impact we were having. We could really measure, wow, we just helped, you know, 40,000 people get out of their traffic debt, or we just saved people in California $19 million last year. Wow. Right. And I mean, you could really like, it's rare that you have a job where you can like quantify at that type of level with that type of regularity the impact that you're having.
Yeah.
And so it was just so special, and it was great, and it was a good way to cut my teeth in public policy because California, you know, from the outside looking in, California is like this kind of liberal monolith, but believe it or not, most of California is not that way. And so it was this really fun. I mean, talk about thinking about legal institutions, right? Like it was this great opportunity to work directly with judges from like very rural mountain counties that don't really see the world the same way as the judges in say San Francisco or LA would, right? And it was great to work with legal decision makers and think with them about how they approach the concept of willingness and ability to pay and how they just kind of go about their judicial philosophy of like deciding criminal outcomes, right? Yeah. It was such a good job.
I enjoy seeing how enthusiastic you are about it, actually. That's kind of fun to watch. And so it makes me think that maybe you're going to take that experience with you with whatever comes up next.
Yeah, that's why I joke that it was a lot like retail level policy work, right? Because you can really see the impact, and that's been the biggest, one of the bigger learning curves that I've had to adjust to with my job at OMB is that, you know, it's harder to see that impact, right? And it's harder to, because you're operating at that macro level, it's harder to like, you know, see what's happening in the field, right? Mm-hmm. And stay grounded that way. But I think, yeah, that experience really, I mean, I learned a lot from my colleagues at the Judicial Council. And I think from that experience, what I take forward is the lived experience of the people that were using this tool. You know, they shared a lot of information about themselves. They gave us a lot of feedback. And when you kind of take that step back and realize that, okay, this on a ticket or a legal summons, it's a name, it's a dollar amount, it's a list of statutory violations, but that's a person who is trying to decide, okay, do I pay my ticket to soccer cleats, right? Or they're staying up at night and it's just one more, you know, list on the ticker tape that they're just stressed about, right? And so is it not just a great experience to kind of be a social scientist with data? It was a great experience, like in humanity, and realizing, like, okay, legal institutions really affect people, and like these very, very quotidian, everyday ways that I think if you're going to be a public servant, you really have to be attentive to and responsive to, because that's the whole point. Like right. That's what we're doing here.
I want to remind everyone we're speaking today with Colin Christensen, Emory and Henry class of 2014. Who is a Presidential Management Fellow with the White House Office of Management and Budget in the Justice Branch. Colin, Has anything changed for you in the last 10 years, like in your heart or in your mind? Or are there sort of like sea changes, as they say, that have happened for you?
Yeah, that's a great question. Absolutely. I mean, I'd certainly hope so over 10 years, right? But yeah, I think, you know, moving to California right from Emory, I mean, like, you know, literally weeks after graduating, moving out there, it really 100% shattered my worldview. And not my worldview necessarily of like how I view the world, but it shattered how I viewed myself in the world.
Say more about that. What does that mean?
I think at Emory and Henry, I think I felt like I felt like a big fish in a small pond, right? And then I got to Berkeley where everybody's a big fish, and then you realize, wow, like I'm not special. And I remember the very first social conversation I had at the like new student orientation weekend at Berkeley. I was in a circle with people, and everybody was like, "Oh, what did you do before coming to law school?" And you know, the woman to my right was a Fulbright scholar in Turkey, and the person next to her had just spent the summer embedded with a Bedouin tribe to study how elders pass down authority when one of them dies.
Holy cow!
And yeah, and somebody else was like in the music industry. So these people had all done like all of these amazing things, and I was like, well, I was the student government president at my small liberal arts school, which, like, by the way, I won because I ran unopposed, right? You know, like, I just felt immediately. I was like, wow, I feel. It really forced me to recognize that, like, you know, I think during my time in undergrad, and I think any of my classmates will line up and like support this. Like, I think I just like wore my insecurities on my sleeve, and I was really just kind of, I was fueled by them, and which is great. But as a, because it, you know, I think it pushed me to like kind of trying to succeed, but it made me a not nice person, and it made me a not good friend, and it made me a not fun to be around classmate and a not supportive community member. And I think it was going out to California and realizing like, wow, dude, like, you're nothing special here, right? Like, it can both be the case that like you're talented but not special, right? And like that's what I had to learn. And so it was like this deeply humanizing experience. And so I think that's been the sea change, is like being much more like humbled by the world and much more appreciative of like the world around me. And so that's what I mean by shattering my worldview, right? Like, it really just kind of like helped me put myself in a perspective, which I don't think I had any of. I think in undergrad, I was really arrogant and, you know, kind of snooty and just not very nice. And I look back on that and I'm like, oh, what a jerk. Like, that wasn't a way to be. So I think that's the biggest sea change there. I don't really recognize the person that was at Emory and Henry sometimes, right? I don't recognize that version of myself.
I understand that, yeah.
Right?
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I've tried to get my head around as I've gotten older is the notion of, you know, you are who you are right now, but are you that person you were 10 years ago, or for me, much longer ago than that? And it is a weird concept to think that you can be different people in your lifetime, but you really, really can be.
Yeah, it's frankly something that I get a little, you know, I every now and again when I hang out with some of my classmates from Emory, like, so I had dinner with Carter Ayler a few weeks ago. Yeah, he was in town, and it's great because, you know, I find myself having to kind of remind myself that, okay, just as, you know, we can sit down over dinner and like, you know, reminisce and like really embrace the nostalgia of like the do you remember when type stories, there's also this element here where like that, you know, Carter's not who Carter was 10 years ago. Colin's right. Not who Colin was 10 years ago. And so it's really fun having... I have to like remind myself of that. But what's fun about that is because I was in California for so long and like pretty far removed from a lot of my friends from Emory and Henry, it's like getting to know everybody new, like for the first time again in a lot of ways, right? Yeah. And that's a lot of fun. And so I'm really excited for homecoming this year to do all of that at scale. So that'd be great.
I had to ask one more question. Just Berkeley strikes me as an interesting choice for you where you were 10 years ago. And so why did you choose Berkeley over all? Because you're a smart kid, and I know you could have gone a lot of places. What was it about Berkeley that attracted you?
Great question. I'm not really sure. So they offered me a scholarship, so that made it really easy, right? So it was free. And it was not just free. They paid me to be there, right? I mean, I was an indigent grad student living off of a stipend, right? It's not like I was wealthy or anything. But, you know, like it was an opportunity to go to school for free and go to a good school for free. And they flew me out there. Like this like blew my mind. Yeah, this blew. I was 21 years old and they flew me out for a visit trip. Like they paid for it. And they like put me up in a hotel and stuff. From Southwest Virginia to San Francisco, I was like, that is
crazy.
I felt like such a celebrity. This is awesome. And I just fell in love with them. I mean, Berkeley as like geographically, right, is right. It's on the east side of the San Francisco Bay, and the campus lines up basically dead square on with the Golden Gate Bridge.
Wow.
And yeah. And the law school specifically is at the top of a hill that looks down on the bay, and it was like living in a postcard. And then academically, it was great. You know, academically, my visit was cool because I got to meet with all these professors who I'd then spend the next 8 years like working very closely with. And I was kind of looking. I remember at the time my mom telling me, "You really have to find your Dr. Lane while you're out there." And when what she meant by that is like Dr. Lane was my undergrad advisor,
right?
And I think what she was telling me was like, hey, you need you need a good coach. You need a good mentor. Like you do better when you have a coach that you're trying to score a goal for, right? And somebody that you trust, right? And find that person. And I met with a professor who ironically was also an ancient and medieval political philosopher like Joe Lane while I was out there. And I was just like, yeah, I think this guy is really smart and really a special mentor. And so not that I think Joe Lane is he's comparable to none, but that I remember actively thinking like, okay, who can I work with here that's going to give me the type of attention and guidance that I got at Emory and Henry. And I got lucky that I found somebody like that at a big university, like Berkeley. But I don't think there was a whole lot other than, you know, like I said, other than it was free and it was a cool place to live. I don't think there was a whole lot more going on and at the time. Like I said, I was 21 years old. Like, I don't know what I would have been thinking about.
Dude, free and gorgeous. What? I mean, really, do you need more than free and gorgeous? I don't think so.
Yeah, I don't think so either. Yeah, I pretty good calculus.
Exactly. Colin Christensen, Emory Henry Class of 2014, thank you for being our guest today on the Duck Pond Wall.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And I want to thank everyone for listening today on WEHC-FM 90.7, WISE-FM 90.5 and WISE. This is the voice of Southwest Virginia.